My name's Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document.
The scars of war can see personal growth and development. In this episode, we speak to a former Royal Marine who was blown up whilst on operations in Afghanistan. We speak about why he joined the military, the incident in 2011, and his passion for working as a presenter in TV today. Episode 34, JJ Chalmers. This is Declassified. Mate, you joined the Royal Marine Reserves.
Yeah. So I left school 17. I knew I was going to go to university. Funnily enough, I knew I wanted to grow up and be a teacher. Like, I made the decision to leave school and go to university to become a teacher and go straight back into school. But at the same time, I've been a Royal Marine cadet at school. And actually, like, it had just infected me, like the mindset and the ethos of it in particular. So I really wanted to do that as well. And then, I basically met some guys that had been in the RMR. And I just thought, this is the golden opportunity to do both. And more than anything, I wanted an opportunity to earn my green lid. Mm. And that's, that's what I kind of set off doing, having this dual life from the age of 17.
Mm. So you're 17 when you joined. So is that when you went to uni as well, or was it before?
Yeah, so I technically started in the Corps like a month before I even got to uni or something like that. Okay. So it'd be the summer, like right after I left school. So in the summer, I did the PRMC, the Potential Royal Marines course, and then started training in, I think it'd be like August time or something like that, and then started at uni in September. And, that sort of first year at uni that everyone goes absolutely wild and has, all that sort of stuff, that wasn't my life at all. I was coming home from uni and I was cracking 2 hours fizz because, and it's, the onus is on you to do all those bits and pieces, because the time you actually get with the Corps on the weekends or the long exercises they send you on, 2 weeks here and there, you're being tested effectively.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, your physical ability's got to be there because you've got to spend time in the field learning the green skills.
Mm. Self-discipline and just keeping going,
proving
it. How long does it take then from joining the reserves to...
It took me a year to get my green lid.
And is that standard, is it?
That's pretty standard. Again, it's probably changed nowadays and things like that. But basically what it was you joined and you did 6 months and you were sort of doing two nights a week and maybe three weekends a month or something like that. You were doing time with the Corps in the field mainly. And then it was up to you to do a lot of the learning, studying and cracking the fizz. And we were really good. We had a bunch of good lads who, I'm still in touch with today. And we were all kind of living near each other. So like we were actually bonding and training together outside of our allotted time with the Corps. And then sort of at the 6 month mark, you go down to Limpston, CTC Limpston, where all the Marines train, and you do a 2 week exercise where you're tested to the same standard as everybody else. And so if you're not up to scratch, you go back and you have to do that again. I was up to scratch. And so you begin the commando phase of it, same detail again for 6 months, jump through all the hoops. And when you're good enough, they send you down to do your commando course. Again, 2 weeks. First week is a big field exercise, final exercise. And the second week is the commando test. Go through jump through all those hoops. And then back in our day, you had to come back again for like another 2 weeks of field firing and then another like commando skills package or something to be like fully deployable. But you had your green lid by that point.
But it's still the same timings?
Still the same timings, yeah, absolutely. And quite right, it should be, because at the end of the day, the job you're doing on operations is the exact same job. So like the fundamental difference, I think, is that a lot of the onus is on you to make those standards because you're going to get found out. You're just not going to pass. And as you know, actually, you're going to get beasted more by, pays to be a winner, basically, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's completely, you're expected to get up to the standard.
What was the balance like then between, training to be a teacher? And the focus, I suppose, as well, between, studying and then training as well.
Yeah, pretty schizophrenic, to be honest. Like, it's really weird to just sort of... throughout my time in the Corps as a reservist and then when I went on and I was a full-time teacher, I remember these moments, like, sitting in the field being like, what am I doing here? Like, I'm a teacher. Why am I sitting in a puddle here? Like, I should be in a classroom, warm. But then... On the flip side, I find myself sat in the classroom sometimes being like, I wish I was in a puddle right now.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The thing is, I had two things that I wanted to achieve in my life, and I was really lucky to achieve them both. By, you know, I got my green lid at the age of 18, and then I became a fully qualified teacher by the age of 21. Mm. So like to actually have managed to crack both those things so early on, I was mega pleased with.
What was you teaching, primary or senior?
Senior. So design and technology. So like my subjects cover everything from like woodwork to graphic communication. Which, I mean, I absolutely loved it. I really did love it. And like when I left uni, I worked in a school in the south side of Edinburgh, and it was really, really good. Like, it is an amazing privilege to get to, you know, form children's lives. And it's so much more than just actually teaching them how to make pencil cases. It's actually about, you know, taking these young people and sort of influencing them to go off and do what it is they want in life, etc. And, you know, I really, really thrived on that sort of stuff. But at the same time, during my summer holidays, for example, in particular, because teachers and students have long summer holidays, I was away with the Corps. Like, I had this, you know, that was it. I just disappeared off. And I was mega lucky, actually, in my time in the Corps. Like, I got to go to, did two exercises with the United States Marines. I'd spent time in the Falkland Islands, which, you know, actually, for anyone that's been to the Falklands knows it's actually fairly gash, but but with rose-tinted glasses on, it was an amazing thing. And like, who gets to do that? Who gets to go to Ascension Island? Like, I was really absolutely living the dream when I got to do it.
When you do it, the reserve, do they integrate with?
Yeah. I mean, it just depends. Sometimes you go off on exercises that are sort of, you know, just RMR ones or whatever it is. But actually, the best exercises is when they just, like, I went to the jungle with Fleet Protection Group. And so literally they just take you, just like you would do in operations, they just take two or three blokes, all right, you're in that troop, and you just go off and do the same exercise that they're doing.
Mm.
And like, that is the best time. And it's the same with, like, I did an assault engineers course. Like, I just went and did the regular assault engineers course. It's just, you know, some of the parts of it you learn when you're, you know, up in Scotland at your normal unit, but like the demolitions, mine warfare, all that sort of stuff, you've got to go to CTC and pass their standards. So, you know, you just get bunged on the regular course.
Mm. Who was the engineer course with? That with the Royal Marines?
That's with the Royal Marines. So it's just run out of Limpston. So the assault engineers run their own course. And it was brilliant. I'd say I'm a pretty average. I was a pretty average Marine, you know. Some would say there's no such thing as an average Marine, but like, you know, I was decent at soldiering, you know, and I was determined as anybody else, and I had the same green lid as everybody else. But actually, when it came to being an assault engineer, I was pretty damn good at it, if I don't say so myself. And I just loved improvise, adapt, overcome. Like in Afghan, I held the place together, you know, our checkpoint together with cable ties and duct tape, you know, just because in Afghan, like, it's that perfect example of a place where the level of comfort that you have is completely dependent on how much effort you want to put into it, basically. And like, I just love it. Like, I'd love to just be abandoned on a desert island. You know, that's my idea dream.
Yeah, I mean, like, the amount of HESCO you've got dictates the level of gym equipment
exactly
you've got. And obviously, there's plenty of sand to weigh it down. Did you leave teaching then and join full time?
Yeah. So basically, having gone through uni 4 years and in and out of schools throughout the entire time at uni, the beautiful thing was actually you spent half your year sort of in university, in lectures and all that sort of stuff. And to be quite frank about it, it's completely pointless because like you're learning on the job is the way to do it. So the rest of the time you spent in a school just being a teacher, you had backup from the other teachers on you. But at the end of the day, like, you can read all the textbooks you want. If you can't control a room of 20 plus kids, there's, you know, no point, you know?
Mm.
So actually being in a classroom was brilliant. So I did that for 4 years. Then I went away and you have to do a probation year. So you have to do a year's teaching with a bit of assessment along the way. And then that's you. You've got a tick in a box and you can be a teacher for the rest of your life. I still pay my subscription to the General Teachers Council. Like, if this all goes wrong tomorrow, I'll just go put myself on the supply list. Like, I'll go be a teacher tomorrow. It's great. But basically, when I finished at that school, my contract was for 1 year, so I had to go try and find a job. Jobs were pretty scarce in Scotland at the time, and I knew that I was going to go and try and apply for jobs that all my mates that I'd gone to uni with were going to apply for, and they had no other choice than to go and get a teaching job. I had this other life that I really wanted to do. I wanted to spend time with the regular Corps by this point. And it was just my turn to go to Afghan, really. Like, that's the thing. Like, you know, Afghan was in full, you know, had been going on, like, pretty full on for about 4 or 5 years by this point, and everyone was taking their turn. So I knew I'd have to take my turn. And basically, that was it. I walked before I was pushed. I stuck my name in the hat and said, I want to go.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, best decision I ever made, believe it or not.
When did you go out?
So I went out in 2011, Herrick 14. So I almost went on Herrick 7. I actually started all the beat-up training for it and everything. So it was going to be like a break between second and third year at uni. And then the uni kind of stepped in and said, oh, we're not that happy with it and everything else. And at that point with the core, I kind of got a bit of an unwritten agreement that basically they said, right, go away, finish your studies, tick the boxes you need to tick. Because they knew what the rotations were going to be by that point. They knew that they were going to be in Afghan for the next 4 or 5 years, whatever it was, and they would be on deployment this summer, that winter, whatever it was. So they said, Herrick 14, that'll be you. Mm. And so yeah, I went, like I say, went with open arms.
You remember going out?
Yeah. So I joined my unit at the sort of tail end of 2010 and began all the beat-up training. And, you know, the lads had been together probably since the summer because the Marines, they move around so much in jobs. Like, you really only spend like a year and a half, 2 years on a draft, and then you move on to the next job. And particularly in the Afghan days, they were always bolstering the numbers in the units that were going to go to Afghan. And then as soon as they came back from Afghan, just stripping all the blokes out, moving them to the next unit that was going to go to Afghan. So like the guys had been together for maybe like 3 or 4 months at this point, and then, you know, me and a bunch of other reservists arrived, basically just got pinged off into different troops. I got a really good troops and a really good company straight away. So I was in J Company at 4-2 Commando in a fire support group. So good senior lads, guys with lots of operational experience and loads of junior lads as well, kind of fresh out the box. But it was a really good, really good trip. And so we did sort of 5-6 months of like serious beat up, getting ready. And at this point, you know pretty much exactly where you're going to go to in Afghan and exactly what job you're doing. You're getting INT reports back like weekly about the place that you're going to take over, etc. So like we have a really good idea of what it's going to be like. And so then we deployed at the end of March out to Helmand.
Did you, by that point, when you deployed on the flight going out there, was you connected with the other guys then?
Yeah,
was
totally.
You fully integrated, banter, all that kind of stuff?
Totally. Zero difference. I mean, the RMR, the reserve forces, whatever you want to call them, you know, we get a healthy amount of banter about, you know, being rubber daggers or whatever it is and all that sort of stuff. But actually, particularly through that decade of Afghan when lads were just going in and out, you know, when 40 Commando went to Afghan on Herrick 7, 10% of their numbers were RMR, like they were reservists.
Yeah.
But again, they'd done all the beat up with them. And then on the flip side, you do get a lot of good skills and stuff, and you know, that come into your units, because these blokes are actually plumbers, and you know, they're joiners and things like that. So they've got assets that you can use. Mm. There's blokes that are policemen, and actually, you know, they know more than probably the MPs do, you know, about you know, being a policeman. And so, you know, my skills as a sort of craft teacher and whatnot, and completely dealt into being an assault engineer. Like the first thing I did when I arrived at my unit 4-2 was build a bar on the landing, and it was just like, we called it the Stumpy Arms. That was it. It was like, as soon as I built that bar, everyone was like, he's a good lad, because you know, you just got
the first thing you do. I was thinking, please say build a bar.
Yeah, so yeah, I'm completely integrated into the unit. I mean, maybe the lads will tell me otherwise, and you know, they thought I was going to get them all killed. But no, I mean, and I was in a, you know, surrounded by absolutely brilliant blokes, and you know, I felt like I belonged there. And you know, we knew exactly what our job was, and we got stuck in.
What was your job?
So we were going to a part of Afghan, deep in the green zone in Helmand Province in Nadi Ali, where we were ground holding basically. So we knew we were going to go to a checkpoint, and that I always say that our job was quite like policemen, in that we had like a beat around our checkpoint that we had to patrol. And sometimes that meant sometimes, most of the time, that meant knocking on people's doors and finding out what they needed and just trying to reassure them and make them feel safe and all that sort of stuff. And sometimes it meant going out and hunting the bad guys, and sometimes it meant going out and kind of being bait for the bad guys to come to you, and, you know, so that other guys could try and arrest them. It was cat and mouse. But, like, we were there for a couple of months, and we really, like, in the area that we like, owned the ground of, we did it, you know, we had it pretty good.
Did you always feel like you was in control? Because, you know, you're looking at a really kind of rough period in the military. Did you feel like professionalism was kept at a high? Did you feel like you were adhering to every rule? Did you feel like that you could do that?
Yeah, so the thing is, certainly at the beginning of the tour, we were in control, or certainly thought we were in control. But the problem is, particularly with IEDs, is that sometimes when you feel you're in control, you can begin to get complacent. And actually, I would judge a lot of it by, did we begin to get complacent and comfortable in our surroundings? And actually, we managed to keep that presence of mind that actually, just because we weren't getting, like, there was explosions going off every day and lads around us were getting hurt, but, like, for, you know, our troop hadn't been hit yet, or our company hadn't been hit by IEDs anyway, or had a few close calls but nothing significant. So you can begin to think you're getting complacent, and that's when those standards and values come in. That's when, you know, your discipline just absolutely comes to the forefront. And, you know, those are the things that I joined the Corps for. Like, I joined the Corps because I wanted to be a frontline soldier. And I wanted to be surrounded by the best blokes that I could possibly be surrounded by. But a big part of it was, like, living and breathing commando spirit, you know, courage, determination, selflessness, that kind of stuff. And I was seeing it day in, day out, but not always in an environment where it was like bombs and bullets. You're seeing unbelievable courage and determination. It was actually to go out knowing there was this silent threat there, and that we were getting lucky a lot of the time. Actually, I remember one patrol, we went out and we just had that moment of, we need to get from A to B, and one of the corridors we were going to go down, it was like an alleyway, we just went, not today, lads, we're not going down that one, for no other reason than because that's an obvious channel, yes, but actually sometimes you've got to go through the obvious channels because there's no other choice. Because that's the problem. They channel you in, they put an IED in that place, and, you know, that's the best chance of hitting you. Sometimes there's no choice but to go through the obvious channels, but sometimes it's also like, well, they know that you're not going to go down that obvious channel. So
they know that
he knows. And so it's such cat and mouse that, anyway, you're pulling your hair out, but we decided not to go down this alleyway, you know, boxed around it, cracked on. 2 days later, we were patrolling back around a similar area, looked down the alleyway, and you could see where the IED had been dug out and moved to somewhere else.
Really?
And you're just like, fuck.
Did they treat them as assets then?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's no shortage of munitions out there, and you know, there's a lot of IEDs, but yeah, they're weapon systems, and if they've not worked in one place, they get moved to another place. Like, they do seed the ground heavily, but, like, they're pretty smart about where they want to put them. And like, they might have seen that we didn't go down that alleyway and then made their appraisal that that's it. We don't go down alleyways like that, so we're wasting our time by putting it there. You know what I mean?
What's your opinion of, I suppose, like, in brackets, like the Taliban? What's your...
I mean, there are varying levels of Taliban, for starters. You know, some of the guys that we termed Taliban, what we used to call a $10 Taliban, are those blokes that are literally being paid $10 to come and, you know, shoot at the, you know, security forces, whether that be international or Afghan ones. And most of them are just guys that came over from Pakistan to be part of the opium harvest, and then they hang around for a bit. And then that's just a good means of income, is $10 a day to have a crack at us. And so to them, actually, you're kind of like, well, fair play. Like, you've got no training whatsoever. You know, and you're going to come and try and take on some of the finest soldiers in the world. Like, that's pretty fearless, pretty ballsy. But also, it's because, let's be honest, it's because they're being forced into it too. Like, so actually, you know, if I loathe any part of that enemy, then it's the sort of the middle, it's the command structure within it, where you get the much more extremist blokes who have got good training, actually, and are pretty sneaky, and, you know, you've got to respect your enemy because it'll get you in trouble if you don't. And, like, you know, again, they're scrapping against, as I said, you know, the finest forces in the world with some of the greatest assets going. But by the time I got to Afghan in particular, they didn't like a stand-up scrap anymore, and they were quite happy to put IEDs down in the ground, and they were quite happy to use the local population and kids and whatnot as scouts, or to use them and, you know, do some pretty nasty stuff to them. And so you get pretty threaded with that part of it. Because the other thing is that we were living in amongst the local population. Like, we got to know them really well. Like, we had neighbours, you know, and, like, the kids used to come around and play at our compound, and they were nice folks.
Mm. What's the, again, your opinion on kind of the children in Afghanistan? Because obviously you was around them, like you said, they were part of your mini community for that period of time, or you was part of their mini community for that period of time. Is there a lot of orphans? Is there a lot? What's the deal with the kid?
The civilian population, full stop, is pretty much stuck in between all this nonsense. It's stuck between the, you know, Taliban and the security forces and whatnot, and they're just sitting on the fence as well. Like, they're trying to figure out what your intentions are and whether you're going to stick around. And they're tired of war and conflict and all that kind of stuff. But also, when you look at the kids in particular, they know nothing different. Like, they've absolutely just grown up surrounded by this for generations. It's just what's happened there. So for example, one of the kids that I remember meeting, and it really sticks with me, this, and in some ways it's got nothing to do with the war, but it really kind of, I mean, it didn't affect me badly, but it really stuck with me. So we were on patrol one day, knocked on a door. How can we help you? What's going on? Et cetera, et cetera. Probably like a mile away from our checkpoint at this point, in a pretty dodgy neighbourhood actually as well. But it was pretty quiet. It was peaceful. Knocked on a door. I think the grandfather, the elder, came out, chatting to him. What can we do? How can we help? And he said, oh, well, my grandson has broken his arm. Can you take a look at it? And I was like, yeah, we've got a medic. And actually I went, Cass Little, I think you've spoken to him before. He comes up, Canadian bloke, hilarious. Anyway, he comes up. I said, Cass, you want to take a look at this kid's arm? Expecting him to come out, sort of, I don't know what I expected to come out, but basically comes out and his arm is on backwards. Like, it's horrendous. And I was like, what has happened to that? And the kid had fallen out of a tree, broken his arm, but had no medical help, no NHS, none of that good stuff. So it healed, and it healed in a horrendous disfigurement. And as a result, you just kind of had that moment where you realised, well, there's nothing you can do for that. Like, there's no facility there where you can break his arm, put it back together, rehabilitate him, get it working again, etc. And knowing how that culture works, for example, you know, he's going to grow up with that disability, that disfigurement. So he's going to get pretty much ostracised from society. He's not going to get a job. He's not going to go to school. He's not going to do any of those things because he fell out of a tree. You know what I mean? Like, we growing up as kids, getting a stookie was like a rite of passage, you know, getting a bandage on your arm. Mm. And this kid had fallen out of a tree and probably ruined the rest of his life. That's not a kid that stepped on a landmine and lost both his legs. That's just a kid that's fallen from a tree. So, like, if you can look at it and go, the normal stuff is that bad. How bad is the conflict part of it? And it's pretty gopping.
So vulnerable. Children, and, you know, you've got little ones now. I have similar age, you know, our kids, and I can't drop my children metaphorically into there. I can't imagine it. It's so far removed, and these kids are so vulnerable. And moving on, like, we speak about vulnerability, and I suppose a patrol, especially with IEDs, is extremely vulnerable. Who was on your patrol in the incident?
Yeah, so I got hit on the 27th of May 2011, and so we'd moved away from our home checkpoint, and we'd pushed out the envelope into you know, Taliban heartland at this point. We'd set up like a temporary checkpoint as part of a really big operation. Basically, it was a massive operation, like thousands of troops from all parts of, not just the British military, but, you know, all ISAF nations coming together to secure kind of a big area of Afghan. But, like, when you cut it down into smaller bits, 4-2 Commando's objective was a village called Loimanda Calais. And so to secure that village, 2 days before the operation began, our company flew into this, like, farming compound, this farming, you know, farming village, little size of a football field, high wall, kind of standard. Anyone that's been in Afghan knows what it looks like. And secured it with the intention of basically bringing all the fighters, Taliban fighters, to us, in particular, drawing them out of the village. Mm. And so 2 days later, Lima Company, our sister company, came in and took that village completely unopposed because all the fighters were down south scrapping with us. And so we called it Operation Tethered Goat because we were just bait. But it worked perfectly. But at the same time, we were getting absolutely slammed. So we had what we would call like company minus. So it's probably like 50 blokes or something like that. Probably like 4 or 5 multiples of Marines. I think we had a troop of engineers as well. And we just like we had about 3 hours to fill sandbags and kind of make this place as secure as we could. And then we just started getting hammered, just like
small arms.
Small arms. The small arms were, you know, AK, PKM, that kind of stuff. That was bad, but the worst bit was the UGLs. They were just lobbing grenades at us. These, you know, as grenade launchers. And you just knew they were getting their eye in, basically. So, like, the first time they scrapped, they were landing short. The next time, they were landing long. And we were just like, it's a matter of time before they start falling in this checkpoint. And lo and behold, on the first night, I just got my head down. I'm lying in my pit, and I just wake up to a bang in the compound. Someone screaming medic. Then Cass, who was, I think he was on Sanger for some reason. He shouldn't have been as the medic. But anyway, he came running in, grabbed his kit, and just disappeared out into the darkness before I'd even had a chance to open my eyes. And anyway, basically, three lads had DMV. So we had to move them away from the other blokes. So we had to plonk them in the middle of the compound. And so it had come in and landed in between the three of them. Thankfully, no one was like significantly hurt, but we had to casivac those three blokes. Actually, we had to casivac those three blokes, but then there was a dust storm at Camp Bastion, so the helo couldn't get off the deck. We actually cleared the HLS, the helicopter landing site, 3 times that night. Kept going out. Oh, it's not coming. Kept going out. It's not coming. Because they weren't like Cat A casualties, so they weren't coming with that much of a sense of urgency. So in the end, they ended up only casivacing 2 blokes, and one of the blokes just stuck an FFD on and cracked on. Anyway, so that was day one, and then we had a bloke shot on the third day, and then they were winning, basically.
Yeah,
they were winning. Anyway, on the fifth day, we kind of pushed them back a bit, and we were able to sort of start launching patrols and all that kind of stuff, and basically it came down chain of command that they suspected there was a bomb-making factory in the area, and 3 multiples headed out on the ground, and my multiple was one of them, and we were kind of going out satelliting around each other. So it was probably about 30 blokes total, and there was like 10 of us. Probably, I think we were about 9 Marines, and then we had an engineer attached to us as well. We were being led by our boss at the time, who was a lieutenant, Ollie Augustine. Everything was going pretty good, to be fair. Like, we went out first thing in the morning, and we patrolled until about 12 o'clock, hunkered down for some lunch in an Afghan compound with some lovely locals. Like, we were sat on this like beautiful pitch of grass with like vines growing over the tops of our heads, eating Afghan bread, eating, you know, drinking their tea. It was all too good to be true, basically. Because then we started asking about the neighbours, the suspected bomb making factory, and then shortly after, the environmentals all started going down south. And then we started realizing, you know, as we moved.
What do you mean, environmentals?
The environmentals. So, like, you know, the environmentals, the overall sort of presence of, you know, civilians, for example, was pretty good. You know, people were around and they were talking to us, right. And it all felt really nice. And then basically, when we left there and started moving towards this building, this other compound, it all, like, you started to realize that those women and children that had been there 2 minutes ago weren't there anymore. And so we were like, oh, something's about to happen. And we, you know, we've been pretty much scrapping in our compound anyway for 5 days now. So, like, the IED threat is always there. Not that we were getting complacent, but our number one threat at that time was thinking they're going to hit us kinetically. We're going to get shot at. So basically, we'd move from having lunch to go into the compound. Our multiple split in half. So the first 5 lads went in. So I think, like, one of the corporals took in 4 lads and they kind of secured it. Both by, you know, putting out sentries and whatnot, but also metal detected it, mind swept it, made it as safe as we thought it could. And so it's 1 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and we're in open ground, the 5 of us. So we're like, we better get in that compound quick because it's starting to get a bit dodgy here. So we got in, and, you know, that's a bit hard cover, felt a bit safer. But not safe in the sense that we were going to start like taking our helmet and body armor off and all that sort of stuff. Like, we knew something was about to happen. We really thought we were about to be ambushed. Anyway, but at the same time, it felt pretty normal. Like, I felt like I was just at work. Like, that's not an extraordinary day in Afghan. It's just a normal day at work. Anyway, I'm talking to my boss, basically. We searched the compound. Bit suspicious. I don't think it was necessarily, it was definitely a workshop of some form, whether IEDs had been built there or not. Still don't know to this day, but we found a few suspect kind of things knocking around. And also there was no one in it. And so the one thing I would say is that whenever we find like an empty compound in Afghan, it's usually empty for a reason. So either it was booby-trapped or it was used by the Taliban, so locals. Because the Taliban, they move from, you know, like they have multiple safe houses, as it were, and they'll go from one to the other. So they just didn't happen to be using this one at the time, for example. And so on any given day, we'd have just stayed clear of it. But that was our job. Our job was to go in and search that building, as suspicious as it may be. And so people all talk about what happened next, as you were in the wrong place at the wrong time. But I wasn't. I was in the exact right place, exactly where I was meant to be, at the exact time I was meant to be there. And in many ways, my entire life had built to this moment. And anyway, as I say, completely normal. Friday afternoon, 1 o'clock, talking to my boss, and then whack, I'm on my back, and I feel like I've been hit by a train. Like, I don't even know what's happened. I'm just in so much pain.
Mm. What had happened?
So, the boss, or at least somebody, had stepped on an IED, pressure plate, big bomb had gone off. 5 to 10 kilos of homemade explosives had just rattled through this compound. Like, I'm talking, like, my mate Louis talks about it quite a lot, the lad that saved my life. And, you know, he tries to stress to people that, you know, that in movies, bangs are either way too big, you know, they're like huge, huge, massive, ridiculous fireballs because someone's throwing a grenade, or they're kind of the classic bomb goes off and the hero's kind of stood next to it and nothing happens to him. Like, this thing chucked a dust cloud into the air that was like 40, 50 feet high. It's just huge. And it's in a confined space as well, because they kind of sneakily planted it in a tunnel, effectively, in the compound.
Mm.
And you know explosives. They look for the path of least resistance when a blast goes off. And so, because it's in this confined space, in some ways the explosion becomes even more powerful, because it's not escaping out the walls, it's going out the tunnel. Mm. And that's where I was stood. And so I was stood close enough to the blast to be absolutely smashed to pieces by all the crap that gets picked up, because they're buried in the ground. The ground is hard baked because it's 40 plus degrees summertime in Afghan. And so, like, debris the size of like house bricks start flying off of this stuff and just pummeled me, like bludgeoned me. It's like being stoned to death, basically. But I'm also not close enough to the blast to be hit by the heat of it. And sometimes when you get, you know, some of the lads you've spoken to, for example, have lost their legs, actually there's not that much blood sometimes, because the heat of the blast cauterizes the wound.
Mm.
But because I hadn't been hit by the heat of the blast, I'd just been hit by all this crap. It's just death by a thousand cuts. Like, my entire body is just, my mate described me, two of my mates, best descriptions I've heard is, one of the lads said, I looked like I'd been peeled.
Fucking hell.
And then the lad that saved my life, he said, you just felt like a bag of sand. Like, because I just, all my bones, like in my arms, for example, just like shattered, just like turned to dust in there. My face was crushed, my neck was broken, my legs were just full of holes. I'm just like, I've just gone, my rig's just gone red. There's like blood everywhere. But not like a catastrophic bleed, no like major arteries or anything had been cut. Or some of them had been damaged, but I wasn't kind of gushing blood out of, you know, a big hole, but it was just like...
So losing blood wasn't the main problem?
It wasn't the main problem, but if you'd left it too long,
death
by a thousand cuts, The main problem was it was just a catastrophic situation where lots of people were hurt. So when we talk about these unsurvivable wounds that, you know, I've heard like Emily Mayhew on here talking about, one of the biggest issues was, if it had just happened to me, then the lads would have quite easily been able to deal with it. But at this point, you've got 6 casualties. So you've got ultimately 2 Marines that get killed. Our Afghan interpreter, and those lads were they were killed instantly. But at the same time, none of us are in a position to say that or not. So until they get to a hospital, we're going to do everything we can for them. So the lads were just giving them first aid, regardless. And they weren't showing much signs of life, but they're cracking on. The Afghan interpreter, he seemed like he was all right, but he was hurt. He would later die in hospital of sepsis. And then Cass, our medic, had lost his leg, like right next to me, which is the most bizarre thing, because again, I understand the idea of how an explosion goes off, and basically everything from my knees up has been damaged. And I can understand that, because the blast is on the ground, all the stuff comes up. Whereas Cass has stood next to me, and pretty much he loses one leg below knee, and the other leg, like, mashed up below knee. Mm. And the rest of him's fairly all right. So I'm like, was one of us doing a handstand or something? You know, like, how did that happen? And then another lad, he got blown, like, through a compound wall, basically. Just absolutely... poof. And kind of picked himself up from it. And again, on any other day, if that had been the only casualty, bad concussion, like all over the shop, you'd have been like, mate, are you all right? We gotta save this man. In reality, it was just like the boys looked round and were like, sorry, you're gonna have to get stuck in. So like he just had to shake himself off and just start dealing with the casualties, because half of us were dead or dying basically. And so that was the real issue, was the fact that. We had as many blokes trying to deal with the situation as we had casualties.
It's just such a fucked up situation.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I sit here and talk about it frankly, but I don't believe I was there. You know what I mean? It's nonsense.
It feel like a
it's total
film set.
Two, 3 weeks after it, a year after it, I completely believed it. But 8 years down the line, my life's so different. I don't believe I did that. That wasn't normal. It was totally normal at the time, but it's genuinely. I was watching Band of Brothers recently. Mm. Love that series, absolutely brilliant. And a lad catches up in one of the episodes, I think it's like second or third episode. His face gets all smashed, and I was like, "Oh, that's horrible. I can't imagine how that feels." And I stopped and was like, "I know exactly how that feels." Because that was the first thing that really got me, was that my face had been crushed. And my eyes just felt like they were full of sand. And I just wanted to, you just want to get your fingers in there and try and clear it out. And so that's when I went to use my right arm, and it was gone, basically. It was just like flapping all over the shop from the elbow down. So then I tried to use my left arm, because you want to try and give yourself first aid as well. I went to use my left arm and I looked at my hand and all my fingers were hanging off. Like I can still remember my fingers tapping off the back of my hand, because they were just hanging on there by like the threads. And at that point, you realise there's nothing you can do for yourself.
When we said, so two of the blokes had died. An interpreter was badly injured.
Yeah.
Cassidy was had a trauma injury to the lower part of his left arm, one of his legs.
Yeah.
You're absolutely fucked up.
Yeah.
Who else?
So then another lad had got like a pretty bad concussion through the, you know, smashed. And yeah, so you've got like four or five blokes still. And not that it would have probably made any difference, but like some of the lads that were hit were like mega experienced blokes as well. So like you're left with like the duty Marines that are the blokes that are coming to our rescue. Like the medic's lost his leg and his Bergen's been turned to dust. Like we've got like no medical supplies.
You had Sam Alexander and Cassidy, both done tours of Afghan before. Yeah.
Sam Alexander had won an MC in Afghan. Right. Yeah. I mean, this is the finest soldier I've ever met in my life. And like the day I left for Afghan, my family dropped me off at Bickley Barracks ready to fly out. And Sam was getting dropped off by his wife, his baby boy there. And my mum was like, all right, you look after yourself. And I said, you don't worry about me. You don't need to worry about me, because I've got Sam Alexander. He's going to look after me. And I genuinely meant that. You know, he was hoofing. And so when my mum found out that he'd been killed, I really hit her hard, because she was like, oh. And to me, when I look back at the situation, and I was speaking to Sam's father about this recently, like when I find solace in could we have done anything differently and all that kind of stuff, which I've moved far beyond now, it's because I know that if Sam Alexander, the finest soldier I've ever met, Military Cross winner, couldn't change our fate that day, no one could. We couldn't have done anything differently. And actually, shit luck has a lot to play with it. You roll the dice enough times in Afghan, basically. And the fact that I survived and he didn't and da-da-da-da-da has nothing to do with being tough, being a good soldier, all that sort of stuff. A bomb went off, carnage was caused, and some of us made it and some of us didn't. I mean, there's a lot to be said for the CASEVAC chain that I went through and the lads that saved us, et cetera, et cetera. But like in that split second when the bomb went off, it was just, you know, you were in the fate of the gods at that point.
Do you remember much of your medevac, CASEVAC?
Yeah, so basically, because I took a knock to the head, what happens, my understanding now, is that your body goes into like protection mode. Like your brain goes into, start pumping all sorts of chemicals around it to start, you know, protecting it. So what happens is everything you've seen that day, which is sitting in your short-term memory, it's as if it's not being saved. And you know when your computer like goes out, you know, you lose power or something, and it brings back your Word document, and it's kind of corrupted a little bit. That's what's happened to my brain, basically. So I ended up remembering maybe six or seven split-second moments of that entire day, but it's enough that I can weave the narrative together. Like I could take you to the compound that we went to, like, because I can still remember little bits of the day, and so I remember the moment. I remember getting up in the morning. I remember standing around the map. I remember a couple of points in the patrol. I remember sort of going into the compound. I remember being hit, like the dust settling and me kind of coming to grips with what the hell had happened. I remember seeing my hands, etc. I remember a bloke jumping on top of me and trying to give me first aid. And I remember him trying to put morphine in me and just being like, oh, that feels amazing. But in reality, he just jabbed himself in the thumb with his morphine pen. But he's like, yeah, it's in, mate, don't worry. I'll get you another one. So like I remember these little bits up until basically the point. Two of the points I remember. One was quite crucially. One point was these two lads had given me first aid, and then they went, JJ, there's other blokes hit here. We've got to go and look after them. We've done all we can for you. And I remember being like, don't leave me. Like that's like, but at the same time thinking, you got to go. You got to get on with that. So like being afraid, and then he says to me, yeah, but listen, mate, just keep screaming so that we know that you're still with us. Basically, just keep shouting out, keep talking to us.
Hell.
Yeah, and I was like, easy. But actually, as soon as they left, I remember thinking to myself, you know what? You're not taking this well, right? Bruce Willis doesn't scream like this, right? When he gets blown up, so suck it up, get on with it, go quiet. And so I went quiet for about 2 or 3 seconds, and I went, actually, if you're ever allowed to scream about something, this is the moment. So I just like, because the thing, the screaming was me just trying to get the pain out of my body. I got to do something to try, and I was just wriggling around on the floor, just like,
dying. What is the pain like?
I just felt like I'd been crushed. Just every part of my body was
Could you breathe?
I could breathe. But like my face was throbbing with pain, my legs were throbbing with pain, my arms had gone pretty much numb, but like I was just, I felt like I was on fire, basically. Mm. Like it was horrible. And then I heard them say, wheels up at Bastion. So it meant that the helicopter had taken off at Bastion and it was coming our way. And because we'd had to CASEVAC like 4 or 5 blokes that week, I knew how quickly that meant. It meant you've got about like 30 minutes until it's helos here. And so there you go, about 25 minutes later, the helo's circling. And basically between, you know, those moments of hearing wheels up at Bastion, I just remember thinking, all right, this is it. You just need to suck it up and get on with it. Like, I kept screaming and everything, but I was like, if you can make it through the next 25 minutes and get to that helo. Back then we had like a 95, 96% chance of surviving if you made it to a helo.
Mm.
Like, if you get to that helo, you're going to make it. You're going to make it. And so at the point when I started hearing the helo circling, I was like, I don't know what state I'm in. I don't know if I've got my legs or my arms or whatever, but I know that I'm smashed up enough here that I'm going home. And actually, at that point, I was just exhausted. Afghan is just exhausting. Like, I hadn't slept properly for months, and, you know, you're always on edge and all that kind of stuff. And so I was just like, I'm going home and I'm going to get my head down.
Do you think about, like, your family?
Yeah. I thought about my missus straight away. It was just the idea that that's it. I'm going to go home and I'm going to get to see them. I genuinely thought I was going to wake up in Camp Bastion Hospital, and then, you know, the CASEVAC process would begin. But like, I was definitely, I was thinking about my missus, and I was like, I'm going home, I'm going to get to see her. And then I remember kind of being carried out of the compound, and like our stretcher had been blown up, you know. So like the lads have got me on like a sheet of metal or like a ladders or something, like they just whatever they could find for these 6 casualties, you know what I mean? Or 5 casualties plus the 6th casualty carrying the carrying the the set of ladders I'm lying on or whatever. So they got me outside, and then I remember the helo coming down and my mate huddled over the top of me. And then I remember him having this moment of clarity where basically I just looked at my mate, and just as they were lifting me onto the helo, and I said, "Thank you, mate. Thanks for saving my life." And boom, on the helo. And the last thing I remember is just heat of drugs being pumped into me. Just, and I, at that point, they just so the Americans had come and picked me up. So if the British come in the Mert helicopter, they knock you out straight away. Like the record for knocking a bloke out is like 56 seconds from tailgate to asleep. Yes. But the Americans, on the other hand, they don't knock you out, but they're fast. And so they got me. So basically, I know this for a fact because I've got the CT scans that they put me in the CT scanner at Camp Bastion. From point of injury to have been stabilized in the hospital at Camp Bastion and in a CT scanner less than 1 hour.
Fuck.
Incredible. With 6 casualties. Like, insane. Like, that Casualvac chain is unreal. And it only exists because that 6 casualties 3 or 4 years ago before that meant 6 blokes dying, probably. You know, like mass casual like that. You know, you only need to look at something like the film Kajaki and know that, you know, in the early days when you had these horrific incidents, that it could go really badly. Mm. And in many ways, it didn't go that badly. Or certainly as good a scenario as you could hope. Like, as I say, those two lads sadly didn't stand a chance.
Yeah. I mean, just a total fucked up situation.
Yeah.
Do you remember, did you wake up in Birmingham?
I woke up in QE, yeah. I woke up back in Birmingham. I've never really been to Birmingham before that.
Nice intro.
I just remember kind of... So I remember waking up, yeah. And so, you know, you wake up and basically you think you're still in Afghan. But basically you think it's maybe like 2 or 3 hours later. But the reality is you're in Birmingham. You've flown 2,500 miles or whatever it is. And a week of your life is gone. And so it takes you a long time to sort of adjust to the idea that you're back in the UK. And then you see your family and you see the look on their faces, particularly my missus. And I was like, what have I done? Like, because they've just been living through hell, just absolute hell. You know, and my missus, the only person that could possibly make her feel better in this situation is the bloke lying in the bed, like creating all this pain. And, you know, they're absolute heroes because they're not trained, they're not ready for this, you know, and I maybe didn't tell them enough about what was going on, but it was my way of protecting them. And, you know, you lie to them every day that they ask you, is everything going to be all right? You say yes, because part of you believes it's going to be fine. You just believe that other blokes will get killed or injured, but not you. But even the part of you that knew, actually, your number could get called one day, you would lie to them and say, it'll be fine, it'll be absolutely fine.
Did you know the lads had died at this point?
No. So when I woke up, you know, it's just pure confusion as to what the hell's going on. I've got mask on, I've got tubes down my... You know, out coming out of every.
Did you see?
I could see out of one eye. Yeah. One eye, and my head was in a neck brace. So I basically one eye, and I'm just staring at the ceiling. So I wish my family had taken a picture, right? Like, my missus was like, JJ would want a picture of this. And then my mum was like, oh no, we can't do that. And I woke up and was like, tell me you've got a thought of this. Because, like, I'm basically, and I've got some thoughts of me in Camp Bastion Hospital when I've just come off the ground and I'm just like a mummy. They've just covered me in FFDs, like head to toe. And so I wake up, I think I've got a tube down my throat. I've got like a tube up my nose feeding me 10,000 calories a day going in.
Fucking hell, really?
Yeah, and it's still not enough.
Yeah.
You know, you just lose all your muscle, all your fat, etc. And, you know, we're fit as anything. Like, it's the fittest I've ever been in Afghan. I've got these 4 vac dressings on. So what it is like it looks like your arm's wrapped in cling film, and then it's got like a hose coming out of it linked up to like a Hoover that goes, and it's just the wounds are still open basically, and what they're doing is drawing that crap out of them all because you're just full of dirt because these bombs are in the ground and they throw. Once you got to that stage, you're not out of the woods because infection is the thing that's going to get you. Like, you're so fucked and you're full of infection. And, like, you know, my family basically had been told I'd broken an arm. Like, JJ's broken his arm. They were told I was very seriously injured, but they'd said, you know, his arm's broken and they're flying him back now. And there was a lot of, like, it took a lot of time to inform my family and his Chinese whispers in terms of getting the information back. It took a lot of time because they had to inform the blokes that had been killed first and all that sort of stuff. And that's fair enough. But anyway, It wasn't until they got to the hospital and the CCAS team, who are the team that were on the plane with you flying back, looking after you, came in and went, all right, we're going to start at the bottom and work our way up. And so the first thing they say is, well, his legs, they're full of infection, full of holes. And they're like, legs? Didn't even know, like, we just thought it was his arm. And they just work up my body and it's just laying it on, like, you know, he's broken his neck.
Is this them briefing your family?
Yeah.
Right,
briefing family. So it's like, they start at the bottom, they're like, from the knees up to his thighs, covered in cuts, full of infection, that might kill him.
But initially they just tell your parents and your girl, your missus, like, they just say that, what's the worst thing?
They just tell you everything that's happened to him, like all the injuries,
right, okay.
And then they let them come in and see you for like 2 or 3 minutes each.
All right, okay.
And then you're straight into theatre. And you're being, you know, and then that's you. And then I was in this coma for like a week, and you're in surgery every second day, basically. Just like 14, 15 hours of just like mainly debriefing, getting all this crap out of you. So as I was saying, I've got these vac dressings on me, on both my legs, both my arms, drawing this crap out of it. Because basically, what you need to do with these blast injuries... And this necrotic tissue, and listen, I'm not a doctor, like, you know, this is purely from patient's point of view, so there's, you know, some people might disagree, but like, this is what I've come to understand. You've got to clear that infection as quick as you can. Now, the easiest way of doing that is just chop your arms or your legs off, like get rid of it. But they've kind of developed these new dressings, etc., that allow them a bit more time to take their time, etc. And like, I've got a mate who's a surgeon, and he was like, mate, looking at that arm, I'd have chopped it off straight away. Mm. But the surgeons looked at me and were like, his other hand might not survive. So like, we've got to try and save both of these things just so we can hopefully get one of them. And the reality is, I've had this unbelievable turnout. I've still got both my arms, my hands function pretty damn well, etc. But you know, they were like, you know, in that process of telling my parents, all right, his legs are full of infection. His arms are significantly damaged. Left hand's lost some fingers. Da, 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 da. But we might still have to chop his arms off, either one of them. He's broken his neck or fractured a bone at the bottom of his skull. And basically, he seemed to be moving his arms and legs when we put him on the helo, but we don't know if that's the case now. His face is crushed. And that rocked my mum big time, because she was like, am I even going to recognise my son? But I'm absolutely essence, right?
Yeah, for listeners. Yeah, yeah.
But like, it's because they're very, very good at fixing blokes' faces, basically. And they were like, "Oh God, you got to fix his face," and they were like, "No, we'll do that in like 2 or 3 weeks' time. It's not a big deal. Like, we'll get it sorted."
What was wrong with the face?
My eye socket had basically been crushed, and so now it's got a wire and a plate and stuff holding it all together.
What did it look like, though?
It just looked flat, like the right hand side of my face was just flat. My eye was kind of bulging out a bit and stuff like that, and you look like you've just been taken off the ground in Afghan. They expect you to be like, my parents always say this, and my sister always says it, they came in expecting you to look like you belonged in a hospital, e.g. like you were sterile, but you weren't. Like, they just cleaned the bits they need to clean, and you're still covered in dirt. Your hair's still full of debris.
How long was that after?
This is like 48 hours. So you're stabilised for the first 24 hours, and then they can fly you back via Cyprus, and then you're straight into the hospital. They shaved half of my moustache off, because like, only half of it was getting in the way. Yeah. Like, it's unreal, absolutely unreal. And like, I've never broken a bone, never had a stitch, never spent a day in hospital, and now I'm basically sitting on the forefront of medical marvel. It's just ridiculous.
It is absolutely amazing. I mean, if you're listening to this and you haven't listened to the Alexandra Quick episode, to understand the opposite, the actual surgeon going in and dealing with this stuff, short, medium and long term, it's amazing and fascinating. It really is. We would have so much to speak about, right? The actual recovery then, let's fast forward maybe a couple of months.
Yeah, totally.
Right, so you're now back with a group of lads.
Yeah.
When did you get to Headley Court?
So the easy statistics of it basically are, spent 9 weeks in hospital, and in maybe 2 weeks in intensive care, and then 7 weeks up on the main ward, Ward 412, which is like the trauma ward, which is a civilian ward with NHS staff on it, and then depending how many lads have been smashed that month, then it's either like half full of military blokes or almost full of military blokes. But I was in such a bad state of like my independence was so gone, like because I couldn't feed myself, couldn't change myself, none of that stuff. I was going to have to relearn how to use. They're going to have to fix my hands, fix my arms, and then teach me how to use them. So I was in a room on my own. So I wasn't in like a four-man grot, like I've heard like Dave Henson talking, like he was in a four-man room having a great time and stuff like that. So I was still a bit isolated. Like I was aware that the lads were there and, you know, the military support network was there and stuff like that. But I spent a lot of time just in my hospital bed. And it was really frustrating because everyone else in the ward had lost their legs basically, or had broken a leg at the very least. But they were in wheelchairs whizzing around the place. Whereas I was actually stuck in a bed, mainly because, you know, long story short, they had to sew my arm into my stomach to transfer some of the flesh from my stomach to my elbow to patch this huge hole that had been created. And that's so unstable and like just absolutely on the wire as to whether it was going to work or not and whether this thing was just going to fail, this big flap was going to...
Say that again. Where did they put your hand?
So they took... like my stomach looks like a shark bite. And Basically they cut like a big D shape right around my stomach. And along the side of your abdomen, along the side of your body, they leave it attached and they open it up like a big door and then they pop my elbow inside it and then they sew the skin over the top of my elbow joint because they fixed the joint to a degree and they've saved the arm, but it's got a huge hole and you can't just like plaster it. You've got to put flesh on it. You've got to put living, breathing tissue on top of it. And so to do that, to give it the best chance of survival at that point, is it needs to have a blood supply. And that blood supply is coming through my abdomen at the time. So you've got flesh that's now on your elbow, but it's actually getting its blood from my abdomen.
So they attach a vein or an artery into your arm?
I'm attached by like 8-12 inches of flesh, just it's like a sling made of your body.
Okay, yeah.
And then basically what your body learns is to start providing it with start providing that skin, that tissue with blood down your arm. And then what they do is they excise about half of it. So then your arm needs to start working a bit harder. The veins in your arm start working harder to provide this piece of tissue with life. And then after 6 weeks, they take the whole thing off. And now that piece of skin that once lived on my abdomen now lives on my elbow. And like... that's insane. But at the same time, it meant I just couldn't get out of my hospital bed and I was just getting threaders. It's just not a nice way to live. But at that stage, that's when to answer your question from earlier, that's when I found out about the lads being killed, or maybe just a little earlier. And so basically, I was lying in a hospital bed, staring at the ceiling, trying to figure out what the hell had happened and remembering that my mate had said, we've got to go and help the other blokes. So I remember being like, all right, well, there's the other lads hurt. Now, Cass Little was in the bed next to me, our medic. He was in the bed next to me. So I'm like, well, did they mean other blokes just Cass? And I was like, no, it sounded like they meant there was loads of blokes injured. And basically the policy in the hospital is they don't keep it from you, but they kind of wait for you to ask the questions. And so I just one day asked the question. I was like, where are the other lads? You know, what happened to them? Are they all okay? All that sort of stuff. And they told me that Sam and Ollie had been killed. And so at that point, when you're lying in your hospital bed, and I was pretty lucky. I was determined I was going to get better pretty much straight away. But at the point when you're told that information and you're looking at either lying in a hospital bed feeling sorry for yourself or doing everything you possibly can to get out of this place, begin recovery, you know, go on and have a life, whatever it is, you suddenly realize that they didn't have that choice. So you can't quit. Like, they never got the choice to feel sorry for themselves. So you're just going to have to get on with it, crack on, do everything you're told and get fit again. So hospital for 9 weeks. I get like a 2 or 3 days at home in Scotland, maybe. And then they send me to Headley Court. And then you're in and out of Headley Court for like month on, month off or something like that. It was about a year that I kind of did that. And it was brilliant. It was hoofing. I mean, it's hard work, like proper fizz every day, getting beasted by the physios, learning to do all these daily. I always say they gave me a new body and I had to learn how to use it, like, and it's hard, like it's gopping, like learning how to put your shoes on and stuff is gash.
Explain just go over right now, so we'll fast forward and then we'll go back again. What have we got right now, the main kind of characteristics?
So like injury? I've got my right elbow is just like it's like a jigsaw puzzle that's kind of been stuck back together, but it doesn't function anywhere near as well as it should. My tricep's not even attached, like it's just a mess. my right hand has got huge amounts of nerve damage in it, and so like I can barely move my fingers on my right arm. My left arm, I've lost two fingers on it. The other two are sort of, they've been stuck back on crudely, again full of nerve damage as well. My legs are full of holes and all that kind of good stuff. And the number one problem is you've been in a hospital bed for 9 weeks, so like you've got no muscle left. You like, the first time I walked, the first time I got out of my hospital bed, I was like, that, I'll never walk again. I just felt horrendous. Like, the effort it took me to get out of a bed and sit in a chair next to it. Like, they did that for, like, an afternoon, and I went, slept for, like, 2 days. You're just in clip. So you're starting from the absolute bottom. Like, you just have to start again. But, as I say, head to core, it's just full of, like, it was kind of a daunting place to go to, and you kind of, Luke's in it, said it really well. One of the lads, you get dropped off, like, mail in a bag of mail in the night. You just kind of get dropped off, and it's like, this is your new home, get on with it. But very quickly, you ping lads that you know, and like I say, when I look back at it, it was just awesome. You're just surrounded by these absolute legends. And let's be honest, you're surrounded by the cast of Declassified. Like, it's amazing. And, like, there's a part of me that just feels so honoured to be in these guys' presence. And the overall feeling is just not, there's just not an ounce of sorrow in the place. And everybody knows what everyone's going through. Like, they're all, it's all different. There's no blueprint to disability. You know, lads, mechanism of injury may be the same, but everyone's different. But everyone's was just like, all right, we've got this common goal, which is get better and get everybody better. And you just start pulling each other through. And you're also meeting blokes that are further along. Like, you know, I met Joe Townsend, who's already cracked, like, he'd lost his legs on Herrick 7, and he was about to crack an Ironman. And now, you know, 8 years, 10 years later, he won a gold medal at the Commonwealth Games for triathlon. You know, like, you're surrounded by blokes like that. Like, it's hoofing.
Let's leap to sport then. Yeah. We're going to have to leave all of the recovery.
Yeah, and, fair enough.
We're at that point anyway. We know you recovered.
Yeah, totally. I'm fine. No.
Yeah, he's fine. you went to the first Invictus Games, medalled, all that business. You know, that was a catalyst then. It was also a catalyst of where you wanted to be in life and your purpose and meaning. You then went out, you got MD'd on the same day you flew out to Orlando.
Yeah.
2016 to cover the Invictus Games as media.
Yeah. So, yeah, obviously I went to the Invictus Games in 2014 in London, as you say, won some medals there. You know, I had that same process that we've heard, you know, a few blokes talk about sort of rediscovering their, you know, their drive and passion in life through sport. You know, and all the good stuff, the camaraderie of being in the military, the opportunity to wear a uniform again, all that great stuff that it's just brilliant for. But actually, in a kind of unique way, I'd been really involved with, like, the publicising of the games and had worked closely with the media in terms of the documentary they made and the live coverage, et cetera, et cetera. And so that really piqued my interest. And basically, after I'd won my medal, I went into the studio and I was being interviewed by Jonathan Edwards live on the BBC. I mean, Jonathan Edwards is a proper hero of mine growing up as well. Like, you know, absolute legend of a sportsman. But what really took me was watching him do his job, watching him present live telly, particularly when, you know, when he's off camera and someone's talking in his earpiece and he's looking through his scripts and he's rewriting stuff and he's watching the videos back and all that kind of stuff. And then boom, the red light goes on and he does it. And he was just spinning all these plates and it looked awesome. And so I said to him, I said, next time we do an interview, I want to be sat in your chair. How do I do that? And so he was nice enough to introduce me to a couple of people. And basically, because I'd gone through this process, there was my inbox was full of emails from people in the BBC and, you know, and production companies and stuff. And so I went, if you're ever going to have a crack at this, this is the best opportunity. And all the lads were thinking about going out to Rio to be Paralympians. Like, Dave Henson was, you know, right on track to go out there and compete as an athlete. And so I jokingly said, like, oh, I want to get like a pundit job and come out and join you boys. It would be amazing. And Dave goes, yeah, you should do that. You'd be really good at it. And I was like, oh, I'm going to have to actually do that now. And so, but it was nice because it was the first time that somebody had backed me. And so it wasn't just me believing in myself, somebody else believing in me. So yeah, I just pursued it relentlessly, banged out loads of emails and just started looking into what it is I needed to do to become a presenter and navigate the show business world, etc. And basically the first kind of real gig I got was to go back and present the Invictus Games in 2016 in Orlando. And it was literally the day, as you say, I got medically discharged. So the end of one career straight into the next one. And that's, to me, is the point of Invictus, is you get the, you build somebody back up to the absolute pinnacle, feeling as awesome as they did when they were in the military, etc. But what do they do on the Monday after it? You've got to find that thing. And you've got to just continue working with that level of passion, that level of determination that you're going to achieve the next goal. Mm. And for me, the big sort of goal became, I'm going to go to the Paralympics with the boys. And so shortly after coming back from Invictus, I got the job presenting the Paralympics for Channel 4, which was just insane.
Tell me about Rio.
I mean, Rio was amazing. So like we, Channel 4 are, they are amazing innovators, and you know their commitment to the Paralympics and to disability sport is fantastic, but they're also very good at taking chances on people. Like, you know, they're very quirky, and so they saw me and they decided to take a chance on me. And there was also a girl called Sophie Morgan, lovely girl. She was injured in a car crash, you know, and paralyzed from the, you know, and so was a wheelchair user when she was like 18 years old, and has kind of been in the media since. But basically, they screen tested a bunch of people, and then they put us two together, and we just clicked, and it was just like, we're best mates, and we're going to make telly together. And so, for the first time ever, they decided to put two completely untested, people who had never done any live TV and to present the Paralympics, which is insane. Because like when they did like, you know, brought the talent through for 2012, for example, they had like a disabled presenter who'd never, you know, had come through like a talent scheme like I did, or like a screen test like I did. But they were sat next to Jonathan Edwards, a very experienced broadcaster. Like that's what you do. You kind of, you learn the ropes playing second fiddle for a while, and then you get your chance at, you know, being in charge. They just decided, nah, we're going to stick these two guys together and see if they sink or swim. And it was ropey now and again, but we absolutely pulled it off. And I think the absolute pinnacle of that was, so Dave Henson had won his bronze medal in 200 meters, and I'd been there live in the stadium watching it. It was unreal. And then so the next day, which was funnily enough his birthday, He comes into the studio to be interviewed. And like, that's what I'd set out to do, was to go to Rio with Dave, as you know, with the media, and interview him. And I literally sat there, interviewed him, and halfway through the interview, I stopped and I just said, I've achieved my dream. I'm going to have to find a new one, because I'd pulled it off. I couldn't believe it. And like, it felt awesome, because it feels awesome personally, but like, to me, it's not just me pulling that off. It's everybody that's done this, that's got me through this process. Like, I'm sitting there going, this is what the surgeons did. This is what the physios did. This is what, you know, the nurses, my wife, all these people are the reason that I've got this platform and this opportunity. And it is ridiculous. But the amazing thing about telly, particularly live telly, is it's very like being in the military. And what I mean by that is, like, it's a risky job. Like, yeah, no one gets killed or injured, but people saying mean things to you on Twitter when you get it wrong. But live telly has this element of, it could go wrong at any moment, and you're trying to control the uncontrollable, which just feels awesome. But you've also got the courage to do it, because you've got all these backroom staff, and you know that if anything goes wrong, they're going to have your back. And that's what it was like in Afghan. The reason you could go into that dodgy compound is because you thought, well, if it all goes wrong, that big pyramid, that, you know, that system's going to come into place. It's going to save me, and that's why I still thrive for it today.
The part you just mentioned there, where you and Dave sat there, one a medalist, one a presenter hosting the thing. I know Dave will feel very similar. It was all about becoming more than his injury. Is that when you felt like that?
Big time, like. You know, Dave and I, in some ways, you know, actually, I can't speak for Dave, but I know in some ways I leveraged an incident in my life that was a terrible, terrible point in my life, and tried to turn it from the worst thing that ever happened to me to the best thing that ever happened to me. So, like, I did, there's a moment where I leveraged it, because, you know, I'm now in Rio, I'm a presenter, but I'm a presenter of disability sport. And I can speak with I can speak with an authority that I couldn't speak with 4 or 5 years earlier, because I wasn't disabled. So like, there was a part of me that absolutely in that situation, it was because of being disabled and because of the situation that I'd been in. But when I came back from Rio, it wasn't presenting disability sport that I liked. It was presenting sport that I liked. So the first thing I did was like, that's it. I just need to get as much experience as I possibly can, because I want, and I'm really lucky. I have, you know, I've presented the Commonwealth Games now for the BBC, which, you know, yes, actually it does have a disability sport element in it, but it's not. It's an able-bodied championship. It's a multi-sport competition. I was just presenting on their Ride London at the weekend, you know. So, but those things, I want people to just look at me and go, there's JJ Chalmers, the presenter, who once upon a time he was in the Marines and he got blown up, rather than, you know, that's that Marine that's now a TV presenter type thing. Like, I totally want to flip. I'll never get away from Afghan. I'll never get away from that day. It's always going to be a part of me, right? And I'm proud of it, right? I'm absolutely proud of that day, proud of everything I've achieved since, blah, 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 and my military service and all that sort of stuff. But I'm not that bloke. A big part of me is not that bloke anymore. My life's not that life anymore. Mm. I'm now a TV presenter, and my day-to-day looks vastly different to what it used to look like. I'm constantly reminded of it because, you know, I don't sweat the small stuff, and, you know, I ain't no diva. And every time I order a latte, I feel like I'm cheating on myself. I should be having some sort of dirty wet out of a plastic mug, you know, in the field with a blade of grass hanging out of it. You know what I mean? But I just want to be considered good at my job.
Mm. Well, you are. There's been a lot to get to that point as well. This is not just clear cut Orlando, Rio. You know, there's been almost, again, blood, sweat and tears and graft and unpaid kind of work and da, 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 just really pushing and pushing and pushing to get you to the Commonwealth Games last year, to get the D-Day celebrations this year. There's a group of individuals, there's a generation that, you know, you look at them first couple of Invictus that typify it. Those first couple, those, what's the word, like this group of people that push and go way beyond what the expectation was. You know, you talk about unexpected survivors, that's almost infectious now, and you're bringing a whole generation along with you. Where's the future of the Kazivac Club Endeavour Fund? Where do you think we're going?
Yeah, I mean, the thing I always say about Invictus, for example, and what Prince Harry did with it, is that he was lucky enough to kind of see into our little world that we were living in, you know, surrounded by these amazing blokes, you know, and I was surrounded by blokes that inspired me. You know, whenever I had a bad day, I looked at Dave Henson, I looked at David Wiseman, I looked at what these guys were doing, and they inspired me and pushed me forward. And also, it's healthy competition. It's like, all right, well, if he's going to do that, well, I'm going to do this. You know, I've got to one-up him. I'm a Royal Marine. I'm going to do better than that bloke. So there's all that kind of element to it. But it was very funny because then Prince Harry saw that and went, well, actually, we can build a competition out of this and other people would watch it and benefit from it, people outside of the military community. And that didn't even occur to me, and I was living in it. You know what I mean? That's the amazing thing I always say about it. And so you're right. Those first few games in particular, when you had this, you know, the absolute, you know, Kazivac generation coming through, where we had guys that just weren't victims. Simple as that. And like, it's completely Chad, but they're heroes. And the reason they're heroes is because they're my heroes. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, you're not a hero because you get blown up. Like, that's nonsense, right? You're a hero because of what you do with it. You know, David Wiseman's a hero to me because of the amazing charitable work that he does. Dave Henson is a hero to me, and he's the godfather. I was about to say father. He's a godfather to my daughter, because, you know, he's an unbelievable role model. Because he's a Paralympian. He's a full time athlete. He's going to get his doctorate and become, you know, a professor of prosthetic engineering. Like, those are incredible individuals. But the amazing thing is that we've now got to this point. There was a time when we needed help, right? We were in our lowest ebb and we didn't know what we needed. And people had to grip us, whether it was doctors, nurses, charities, etc., grip us and go, you're going to need this for the next couple of years, you know. But now that we've come out the other end of it, like, first of all, we know what we need. Like, we've got to the point that we know what we and people like us need, right? So we need to, and we have genuine expertise as well, right? So the number one thing that we need to begin doing is helping others. Instead of being helped, we need to start feeding back into the system, giving it back in. And not just into the veteran community, but the actual communities that we find ourselves living in. Because actually 90% of the time, I'm not surrounded by veterans anymore. I'm just surrounded by the people that live in my street. Like, you know, when my daughter goes to her playgroup, that's my community now. Like, so I go into that environment and say, well, how can I help? Like, how can I, you need a new bathroom, let's get it fitted. You know what I mean? Like, I've got skills and I've got resources and all that kind of stuff. How can I better the people that are around me? And so we've come out the other end of it, and we need to be given the tools and resources to be able to be able to give back and improve, because we joined the military to serve. So that's what we want to do. We want to serve.
JJ, mate, it's an absolute privilege and a real inspiration, and we will leave it there.